Income tax agenda for 3785. 9 o'clock a.m. Hearing Room A. This is a public hearing and work session on SB 180, SB 181, and SB 182. This is tape 117, side A.
Subcommittee on Income Tax will come to order. This morning we're going to hear Senate Bills 180, 181, and 182. But before we do, I'd like to welcome the students from the Astoria High School, and Representative Tom Hanlon is your state representative. And Tom, do you want to maybe tell them what we're going to be doing or what we're in the process of doing this morning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a subcommittee. In essence, the Revenue Committee has been split in half for the purposes of Thursday and Friday hearings, and we'll be considering some bills here this morning, and I understand that you'll be in the House Gallery early or later on today, and I'll be up to talk to you later. Welcome.
For the students and the other people in the audience that may not be aware, Steve Meyer is one of our committee assistants, and he is going to give us a brief rundown on the three bills that we're going to hear this morning. He'll do this as we hear them. In other words, he won't do all three at the same time. But this may help you orient yourself a little bit also. Okay, Steve, 180?
Right, Senate Bill 180, A and Gross, should be at the beginning of your book behind the first tab. I think they're labeled with the bill numbers on it. This bill deals with estimated tax changes. There's several components on it. One part of it is deals with calculating the interest on estimated tax payments that individuals and corporations make, and to make that calculation of interest the same as it is now for withholding refunds. Another aspect is to when a estimated tax payment is made and there's no specification as to what quarter that it applies to, it says that it shall go to the first quarter for which there's underpayment or an outstanding balance. There's also a provision to allocate any estimated tax between spouses that have made estimated tax payments jointly and then file separately if they cannot agree on the division of the estimated tax payment. And then there's some provisions that deal with the exceptions to paying interest on any underpayment of estimated tax. And these provisions and changes would first apply to tax years beginning in 1986.
Okay, Verlina Sosley from the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Verlina Sosley from the Oregon Department of Revenue. I have with me Don McNeil, who is a manager from our corporation section, and Gary Humphrey, who is responsible for putting out the estimated tax booklet and the estimated forms this time. Our bill, Senate Bill 180, would make certain changes in our current estimated tax laws to conform to some recent federal changes in the exceptions. It also would provide more consistency between Oregon withholding and estimated tax laws, since they're supposed to be pretty similar. I think the easiest thing for me to do would be to go through the bill and explain to you the changes in the sections that we've made. The first section, in Section 1, Subsection D, would change the interest starting date for refunds made from estimated tax. It is not clear in the law how we are supposed to or when that interest would begin. And we would like to make it more clear, make it like the withholding provisions. And basically that means the interest starting date would be 4 months after the due date or the date the return was filed, whichever was later. Without this provision, it would put it under the general statute, which is in 314.4151A, and that would be 4 months after the due date or date paid, whichever is later. To make an example of that, conceivably a taxpayer could file a return several years late and get interest at 18% from the date paid or the date due, whichever was later. if they never filed, for example, like 6 or 7 years, they would get it back from maybe the due date or 4 months after the due date at 18%, and that could be a healthy interest rate for them to receive. We currently aren't doing it that way. We've taken the position that it really isn't paid until that's filed, but it is an inconsistency or unclear in the current law.
Chairman, question?
Yes, Representative
Hugo. In civil and criminal law, the statutes are going away from referral to months and going to actual days. For example, 4 months would be 120 days or 120 calendar days. Is there a reason why you're sticking with 4 months?
Representative Hugo, probably the reason why we've stuck with that is because that's the current wording in our current law. Under the withholding provision, it does say 4 months after the due date, so we just took the current language.
Okay. Can you say the same time? Pardon? Do you understand what I'm...
Yeah.
Okay.
So the next change is in Section 2, Subsection 2. We sometimes get payments made without the estimated tax vouchers, and when that happens, we have to decide how we're going to apply the payment. And what
would you tell us about the voucher? What do you mean when you say that you get it without the voucher?
Okay, in both the corporation estimated tax and the personal estimated tax, we have what is considered a voucher, and it is really not a return, but it says what quarter that payment is being paid for. So first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, whatever. And we receive payments that come in like a check. We'll just say estimated tax, or it'll come in with a letter, say, please apply this to my estimated tax account. It does not come in with a voucher, so we don't know which quarter in which to apply that payment. So we have taken the position by rule now, but we're coming for clarification. We now take that payment and apply it back to any quarter that had an underpayment. Theoretically, that then stops interest on that underpayment. And then any excess over that underpayment would go forward to the next estimated tax due. So this is what this provision in subsection 2 would do, and it is consistent with our current rule.
Marlena, do you run into any problem, or do the taxpayers run into any problem with that maybe messing up their schedules or their accounting procedures? Do you somehow let them know what it's been applied to?
Representative Schoon, we actually haven't heard. This is a very new rule for us. We just adopted it in 1984. We have not heard that. The CPAs and licensed tax consultants were advised that this was going to be our procedure, and we didn't get anything, any comments to the contrary. But we really don't know how it's going to really affect them. One thing that you should know, though, is it's after the return has been filed, we're looking back, so they know how much they paid. So it's not like we're making a choice and then, you know, it's going to be something that's going to affect them forward. We have the return and we know there's an underpayment.
Oh, excuse me, just one other thing. What about penalties in that case, then? May the taxpayer be paying penalties for not paying the full amount when perhaps they think they've paid the full amount for the quarter?
Do you want to take that one, Don?
For the record, my name is Don McNeil, Department of Revenue. My comment, I guess, with respect to your question, Representative Schoon, would be that the estimated tax charges are not penalties as such. It is an interest charge only for the use of money for the period in which there was an underpayment.
Okay.
Okay. The next area that we made changes to is in Section 3. And what this whole section is are the exceptions to underpayment for corporations. What we have done in subsection, 1B, is just change the word tax to taxable year. That was just the drafter's preference of that word, and it conforms to the language in the personal income tax estimated tax programs. In 1C, there is a change, and this would be consistent with the federal law changes. Right now, if you pay estimated tax equal to what was paid on last year's tax, you would meet an exception. What we've added is that tax year would have to have a liability to meet that requirement, and it would have to be over a 12-month period, meaning you could not meet that requirement if it was a short year return, for example, or if you had a loss. And then the next change is, again, to be more consistent with federal exceptions. This would be for large corporations. In the case of federal, a large corporation is defined to be a $1 million taxable income. We have taken $100 taxable income. But in this case, a corporation would not, if they had the $100,000 income, they would not be able to meet or use exception number C, which was equal to last year's tax. It would make them pay at least 90% then to meet an exception. And in subsection 4, this is just a clarification. Right now in the statute, it doesn't say anything about how a taxpayer is supposed to estimate if they have a short year return. We do have rules, but it doesn't say anything in the statutes that we have rules in that area. And so they go first to the statutes, and this was just the clarification. In section 4, all we're doing in
the... Excuse me. What did you say the large corporation was defined as? Income of what?
Taxable income of $100,000.
Okay.
I think you said 100. You did this.
Did I? What did I?
You said $100, but that's okay.
I apologize. $100,000. Thank you. In section 4, we are deleting some incorrect references to some statutes. And in section 5, this deals with joint estimated tax payments, where the taxpayers have filed joint estimated tax payments throughout the year, and then when they file their actual returns, they file separate returns. This may be because they're speaking at the first part of the year, and then by the time that they file their return, they are not speaking anymore, so they file separate returns. Under the current law, it's whoever gets to that money first is the one that gets to claim that on their return. There's also an interesting situation that occurs because if, for example, if I file separate from my husband and I file on January 1st and then later he claims half of the estimated tax, his share possibly, then the Department of Revenue can't even tell him where that money went because of the confidentiality status, because it's sitting on my return. So what this would do, and this is again consistent with what federal does, would allow the department, in cases where they don't agree, if they split it 50-50 and they agree and he claims half and she claims half, or she claims a third and he claims two-thirds or vice versa, there's no problem and we're okay. But it's where they disagree that there's sometimes, we think, needs to be a decision made of who should get what. And federal does that by taking one person's tax liability over both persons' tax liability times the amount that was sitting in that estimated tax account and the apportionment method. And what this would allow us to do is do that for them when there's that dispute. In Section 6, again, we're just deleting some incorrect references. And in Section 7 on page 5, this is the same language as I already explained for the corporations where the payment comes in without the voucher. So this would be on the personal income tax side. And again, that would apply the payment back first and the underpayment and any excess forward. In Section 8, again, we're deleting incorrect references, housekeeping change. And then on page 6, again, this is the personal income tax exceptions to underpayment, and we are making these changes to be more consistent with federal law, recent federal law changes. The first one is in that new subsection 4. Federal now has an exception that if you're a resident in the state throughout the preceding taxable year and you had no tax liability and the preceding taxable year was 12 months, you would still meet an exception. An example of that is where you may have been unemployed, and then you go into back into business or something, you would still need an exception on that first year. Or if you were a student, for example, and you started and then was subject to estimated tax, you would not be penalized that first year. And then what we've done in C and D, where we've deleted that language, we have deleted two exceptions, again, patterning after federal. The first one that we've deleted is 90% of tax on based on actual taxable income. And the second one that we've deleted is this year's tax rates and exemption using last year's income.
Would you explain that, please?
Okay, I think I'll let Gary Humphrey explain both of those exceptions.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Gary Humphrey from the Department of Revenue. You want both exceptions?
Yes, why don't you do both?
The first one, exception C, has to do with 90% of your actual tax over the year. So, like in your first quarter, you figure out what your actual taxable income and tax is, and then compute the amount of tax, and that's what you pay 90% of that, and you'd meet an exception. And the same for the remaining three quarters. Exception D is just using last year's exemptions. Let's see. Oh, this year's exemptions, but otherwise using last year's income. And so those are the two exceptions that we would be deleting the federal.
Wait, D again, please. I'm still not clear. I don't understand what you're saying.
Okay. For exception D?
Yes, sub D.
Okay. You would take last year's income, but this year's exemptions, so if you had more exemptions this year, is primarily who it's aimed at. If you had, like if somebody had a child or something, they could then, by the increased exemptions, it may result in a lower tax that could be used to figure an exception so that they'd have a lower amount of tax using those exemptions and last year's income.
Okay, why is it necessary to delete this?
Well, all that we're doing is just pointing out what federal has done to their exceptions and to see if we can get closer in conformance to them. It's easier for taxpayers and for the department to have them this similar or the same than the computer.
Okay, what's the effect of this then? If it's deleted as an exception, what would the taxpayer then have to do?
Mr. Chairman, they would fall under the exception A or possibly the new exception. They would just have to meet another one of the other exceptions. And those are, exception D, as far as we know, is not used a great deal. Exception A is used a lot, and so they'd probably fall under that. Most people do under last year's tax, and we would still have that exception.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say, too, most people qualify if they pay 80%, which is one we're not changing. So if they pay 80% of the tax due, they have met an exception also. And that's where most people fall into the category. Okay, in Section 9, again, we're just deleting some references, incorrect references. And then Section 10 says that these amendments will be effective for tax years beginning on or after January 1, 1986. So basically, this bill is just to get us closer to what federal law now is.
Do you expect that this will make it easier for the taxpayers and their tax accountants?
I would hope so. The comments that we get, Mr. Chairman, from CPAs, we have every month we meet with the CPAs, and then every quarter we meet with a licensed tax consultants. And generally speaking, in their reactions to us, they like being closer to federal. It makes it easier for them. We don't hear a lot of the time from the individuals that make out their estimated tax.
You shared these with the CPAs and tax consultants?
Yes, we have.
Is there any opposition to these as far as you know?
Yesterday we met with the LTCs, the licensed tax consultants, and they had some concern about us deleting the would be the exception C on page 6, which would be 90% of the tax taxable income. For example, if you paid 90% of your tax, you can take all of your standard deduction. If you had only $1,000, for example, of income, you could take all your standard deduction and show that you really didn't have to pay anything. And so they were a little bit concerned because that is one that their clients do use. But we explained to them also that we were adding the new one, and that seemed to squelch some of the concern there. The CPAs have been very receptive to this change. Okay.
Committee members? Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I go back to Section 5, Sub 4, page 4, lines 26 to 30? In there, it said that if husband and wife fail to agree, I assume the situation is where they failed, they jointly paid an estimated tax and most likely divorce or dissolution is pending and things aren't as rosy anymore, that payments shall be allocated between them according to rules adopted by the department. My question is, what standards are we giving you and what are you going to do with that? That seems wide open to me.
Okay, Representative Hanlon, the reason why we put it by rule is because, and what our intentions are, and I agree that it doesn't say that, but what our intentions are is to adopt the revenue ruling 80-7, which is the federal revenue ruling, and it was, as I explained, where it would be the one tax liability over both times that estimated tax payment. The reason why we did not put the revenue ruling in is because, and what has been happening to us in past times when that's happened, where we say revenue ruling 80-7, then they change the revenue ruling number, or we tie it to a time like December 31, 1982, and then they make changes and we can't. So the rule drafter, or the bill drafter, excuse me, put it in by rule.
If I may, Mr. Chair, follow up. I can see situations where this might be an inequitable ruling. That is, wife paid $10,000 of the estimated payments, husband paid nothing, yet husband's income for the year, wife paid for that out of her property. Husband's income for the year was $20,000 and wife's income for the year was $5,000. Wouldn't we get into something quite inequitable there with that ruling?
Representative Hanlon, it was to correct an inequity right now, because right now it'd be first come, first serve. There is a possibility that there could still be some inequity. By rule, we could still, as those came up, try to take care of those and be broader than what 80-7 is.
And that is your intent then, not only to follow the suggested guidelines of federal ruling 80-7, but to try and deal with these as they come up?
Yes, if they're big discrepancies, yes.
And that ruling of yours, then, would the party that, quote, loses have the ability to appeal that?
The rule? Certainly.
Whatever your decision was in that particular case on how it was allocated.
You always have the right to appeal, yes, Representative Hanlon. However, they also have right to testify on our rules. So if they thought that they should be covered, you know, in a certain area, they certainly have the right to come in and testify on the rule also.
Thank you.
could you restate the question raised by Representative Hanlon to tell us what your intent is with regard to payers persons who have made a disproportionate contribution, then?
Mr. Chairman, our first intention is to adopt what federal has, because it's sort of been tried and tested. There are some other provisions in it for some inequities, and I don't have those completely at mind. It's a very long revenue ruling. But we would first take a look at those and see what is in there, because that's what we plan to put into our rule. And the biggest one of those is where you take one person's liability over both of their liabilities times the amount in the estimated tax account. That apparently gets to most of the inequities and solves them. In the case where there could be a disapportionment, we plan to take care of those by rule. And I, since I don't know what all of those could be, once we're made aware of them, then we can adopt the rule or change the rule to modify it for those. And I really don't know what all of those might be at this time.
Okay. To make it a little clearer, perhaps you could answer yes or no. If in the example that Representative Hanlon stated where one person had paid in the entire amount, would, is it your intent to try to ensure that that individual would be given either the total or the greatest amount of the credit?
I would say yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hanlon, what about on the appeal process? You want to get that a little clearer?
Yes. Were I to be on the losing side of your decision, can you be specific on what my appeal rights are and within the existing system?
Basically, when we make a deficiency, which is possibly what would happen here, because you thought you had an estimated tax amount paid, and we would say, no, you didn't, then you have the right to appeal that and have a conference, and then if you are right, you win at the conference level. If we still think we are right, then you have the hearing level, and then you also have the tax court provision.
The hearing level is administered by who? Who's the judge there?
By the Department of Revenue. Both the conference level and the hearing level are at the department, and then they also have the right to appeal that into the tax court.
Mr. Chair, I just want to comment because of my questions and because of what I do in my other life. I've seen situations come up in dissolutions of marriage where there has been some heavy fighting over who gets what and how, especially including putting these people in the middle. I think this is a step forward because we had nothing before. And I think their testimony is, well, we're not going to be able to solve everything, but by conforming to the Fed's ruling, we're going to be a lot better off than we were.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you. Are there any other witnesses to appear on Senate Bill 180? Okay, we'll open the hearing then. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 180 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 181.
Okay, under the next tab in your book, you have Senate Bill 181, Ian Grills. This deals with the collection of delinquent taxes and makes some changes to that process. One is the being able to pay by credit card to the department delinquent amounts owed the department. This would be a new means of making payment. There's also a provision in the bill that would deal with dishonored checks, bad checks that are given to the department and would provide penalties for that. And then the bill also makes some changes on the collection of inheritance and gift taxes and basically conforms that collection process excuse me, to the process used for income taxes.
Okay, Bruce Loudon, Department of Revenue.
Yes, Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Loudon from the Collection Division of the Department of Revenue, and I have with me Dick Dumit from the Gift and Inheritance Tax Division in the Audit Division.
What is Dick's last name again, please?
Dumit, Richard Dumit. On several occasions, we have brought before the various committees the problem that the Department of Revenue is experiencing with the growth in our accounts receivable. This bill has three elements which would help us address this problem, but it would not be the sole cure for the problem with the growth in the accounts receivable. The three elements which the committee person mentioned would have a small impact, but they're only some of the methods that the department is looking at addressing this problem. Today I'd like to talk mainly how these will apply to the personal income tax program. The three elements in the bill that we have are the first one would permit the Department of Revenue to accept bank cards for payment of delinquent liabilities. The second one would permit the Department of Revenue to assess a penalty for non-sufficient fund checks which had been tendered to the department, And the third would provide for the collection of gift and inheritance distraint warrants in the collection process. What I'd like to do is go through the bill, these three sections separately, and give the committee a chance to respond with any questions that they might have.
Go ahead.
The first segment in the bill is found in Section 2, and this deals with payment of delinquent liabilities by bank card. We see that there would be two main areas where we would use this. One would be in the personal income tax program, and the other would be in the other agency account program. The payment by bank cards would be restricted to payment of delinquent liabilities. In other words, the taxpayer would not be filing a return and say, put my $500 balance on Visa. This would only be used in the collection process. Currently, the only state that is using bank card payments is the state of Alaska. There are several state agencies which use bank card payments, and these would include the state colleges and universities for educational loans and expenses, and the Oregon Health Sciences University, which uses bank cards for payment of medical liabilities. Under this bill, the department would be paying a discount rate of 1.5% to 2.5% based on the volume of transactions which we would process. We would use a terminal to approve payments both on Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. And once we had called in and got approval, this would lock